That was short and sweet. My name's Debbie, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Debbie.
And the last time I took a drink was October 28th, 2001. 2 years ago, I had reached a point in my life where I thought I needed to take Valium. And because of what I believe, I picked up a white chip then. And I'll talk about more about that later. Trying to calm down. I'm an only child, and I was born and raised in California. My dad was Jewish, and back then, because of Hitler and things, a lot of people didn't like Jewish people. So I was taught, from when I could first talk, that I was to tell everyone my name was Deborah Levine, and my last name is Levine, and I was to tell everyone I was French. So I knew, you know, in nursery school, I was French. And also, my mom and dad were divorced before I was a year old, and that was kind of the Leave It to Beaver days. So I was to tell everyone that my dad was killed in the war. So I am a liar. I was taught to lie at a very early age, and that's how I started. You know, I was French, and my dad died in the war. So, I mean, I think my childhood was okay. First time I went to jail, I was in eighth grade. And I thought it was just bad luck. And at 17, I was arrested by the FBI for sales of hard narcotics. And they said they were going to try me as an adult and that I was going to go to prison unless I turned state's evidence. And I didn't. And my mom paid a lot of money and hired a lawyer that went fishing with the judge, and all charges were dropped. So I learned very early on that money could buy me out of any trouble that I got into.
Many arrests.
And at 21, I was in a car accident, high, and went through the windshield and had my nose torn off and was paralyzed on my left-hand side. And a week later, my mom died on Christmas Eve. So at 21, I disowned God and I disowned my family. And I was off and running. And it took me about a year to regroup. And I came out with attitude. And that's how I've run my life, on sheer attitude. I was successful in life, you know. I gave up drugs. I don't talk about drugs out of respect for AA, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. But to paint a picture of what kind of person I was, I was a heroin addict. And one night we were at a house. We were there. And someone got really high, so we said, let's just put him to bed. And we put him to bed, and later on, when we went in there, he was dead. So we loaded him up in the car, and we dropped him off on the lawn at the hospital in the middle of the night and just left him there. And we had too much money, and nobody wanted to get involved. So that happened 3 times. And one night, I did too much. And they said that they were putting me to bed. And I begged them not to put me to bed, because everyone they put to bed died. And I remember being laying there crying. you know, just saying, please don't let me go to sleep. And I went to sleep. And I got up the next day and I got high. And my motto was, only the strong survive. And if you die, you die. And we just kept on moving. And that's how I lived my life. I would walk all over anybody to get what I wanted. And I didn't give a damn. I gave up drugs in my 20s and drank and was successful in life. Drinking was my solution because living life is over my head. And, you know, it's a progressive disease. I was taking my first AA meeting at 21 years old. And I said, I work hard and I party hard. And I'm not willing to stop. I owned a restaurant. Well, I met a man. And we left California and moved back to Michigan. And I stayed with him 12 years. And that was the same person that put me to bed and was just gonna let me die. Or, you know, I said, were you gonna call anybody, you know? And he goes, oh yeah, if we found you not breathing. So that tells you my mind frame. And after 12 years, I'd had enough. I owned a restaurant and I thought I'm working too much and I'm gonna sell all my stock and I need to take a break. And I sold everything and once I quit working, I drank 24/7. And I put myself in detox and I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't know what AA was. And I just thought I have too much time on my hands. So I put myself in detox and I called the cab to come pick me up 3 days later when they released me, and I had the cab stop at a liquor store. And it was on. And I could not go back to detox for 30 days. And by the time I got back, they said that if I kept on drinking, I was gonna die. You know, I was swollen and my liver was shot, and I have a real strong survival skill. So I thought, I need to stop drinking, you know? And I would go back to the doctor every month and have my liver checked. And that time when I quit drinking, it was really bad. They had me on Librium. I couldn't drive my car because I was having anxiety attacks. I couldn't leave my house, you know? And so when I was sober, and you know, I know now that I just transferred the alcohol to the Librium, and I never went to a meeting. You know, and 10 months later, the doctor said, God, I can't believe how good your liver is. And of course, I met my future ex-husband then on a chat line. And because before the computer, you could talk on your phone for like 9-10 hours at a time. And I thought, oh my God, and he lived in Atlanta. So I go, I need to get the hell out of Michigan and get to Atlanta. So so I married him, you know, off the chat line. And that's how I ended up in Atlanta. So he goes, can't you have just two? And I go, yeah, I can drink. And it took a while. And, you know, and then I drink, is what I do. And it started, I used to be able to go to work in that, but it started that I drank. I drank before work, after work, hit it, I mean, I was drinking. So, my ex-husband, the plaintiff, said, you know, I hate you when you're drinking. And I said, well, Houston, we have a problem because I hate you when I'm sober. And from that,
I ended up in treatment. And I thought, God, this is awesome, you know, 90 days. I could go to the tanning booth and go take long hikes and just work on myself. And I met my soulmate in there. And I go, and, you know, I went around. I told everyone, it's God's will that I'm an alcoholic because, you know, for me to meet my soulmate. So, and he's in prison now. But when he gets out, we're going to be married. That's a joke. And so, you know, here I am in treatment. It's all about me. I meet my soulmate, and I go, damn, I'm going to divorce my husband. And so did my 90 days in treatment and was off and running. And I clean up really good on the outside, you know. I was secretary of my home group. I could quote you the book. And never did the work, you know. And 2 years into that, got up one morning and prayed and went to a meeting and left a meeting and drove to the liquor store and bought a fifth of vodka. And I took that home and I poured a big glass and I said, here's to you, God. And I drank it. And I had reached a point where I couldn't imagine life sober, and the alcohol was no longer working for me. So I gave my cats away so they wouldn't starve to death when they found me. And I said, well, I'm just going to kill myself. And the only way I knew to do it was to drink myself to death. That's, I heard people did that. So all semblance of being human was gone. I never left my house. I didn't take a shower. I had half gallons of vodka delivered by cab, and I didn't answer my phone. And I lived in terror. Terror, you know, that I couldn't drink enough. And for me, my disease centers in my mind. So when I picked up the drink, my relapse was over. I had relapsed months before in my head. And I hadn't paid my bills for whatever good reason I had at the time. So I was being evicted. And they were shutting off the electricity and the gas and everything. And I was terrorized that they would shut the electricity off before I died. Because I remember thinking, I don't know what I'm going to do in the dark. You know, so I would leave the TV on. I would drink, pass out. And I would leave the TV on so when I woke up, I would know the electricity was still on. And my ex-husband and a friend of mine from the program came in and said that they were taking me to the hospital, and I said, I'm not going to go. And I remember going into the kitchen and pouring a big glass of vodka and drinking that down. And my friend said that she wasn't going to leave without me to do whatever I needed to do. She saved my life. She took me to Grady, and I was filthy dirty. And I had long hair, and it was dirty. And if anyone's ever been in the Grady waiting room, there's scary people in there. And by the time I got there, black things were crawling up the walls, and they were all over me, and I caused such a scene that they said I was disrupting the other crazy people in there, and they put me in a waiting room by myself. And that's as close to death as I got, you know, and hopefully that I'll ever get, because I was succeeding. I've never had hallucinations before where black things were all over me and crawling all over. So my Grady stabilized me, and they found me a bed at St. Jude's. And I had 4 hours to kill before I went in there, and my friend picked me up
and let me take a shower at her house. And she gave me a clean t-shirt to wear. And she gave me a little brown paper bag with a toothbrush and a pair of underwear in it. And she took me to Grady. I mean, to St. Jude's. And that's what it was like when I came in. I'm one of those that you see all their stuff on the side of the road. And that was me. So from there, I went back into treatment. And I didn't come back to hope to be happy. I came back to hope that I would get the will to live back. And at that time, I was scary when I came back. You know, at that time, the movie, I can't think of the name, but the movie that Demi Moore's in and she's in the army or whatever, and she shaves her head, and I go, oh, yeah. So, you know, I cut off all my hair, spiked it, and dyed it purple. And I came back, and I said, only the strong survive. You know, and I carried that motto with me. And I was scary when I first came in. And, you know, I was always taught that if you're afraid, you walk in and you intimidate everybody and act like you own the place and they don't know you're afraid. And I've run my whole life like that. Sheer attitude, and I will walk in like I know what the hell I'm doing. And that's how I walked into AA, because I was so afraid. And, you know, there was a, I don't know, a news article or something on TV that showed all these dogs that were being abused and, you know, starving to death and that, and they were going in to rescue the dogs. And all the dogs knew to do was to attack because they were so scared. And that's all I knew to do coming into AA was attack. And I felt like one of those dogs. You know, I had to get, I had to get so beaten down that I was willing to settle when I came in if it would stop the pain. I didn't need to be happy, and I didn't need anything, just if it would stop the pain. You know, I was always taught that you never stay down for the count, and you get back up. And at the end of my drinking, I drank and I cried. You know, that binge there lasted a month, solid month. And I would cry and wake up and cry and just pray that I was going to be dead, you know, before the lights went out. And I couldn't get back up. From everything I had been through, I couldn't get back up. You know, so I thought, I'm going to give this a shot. Because I'm either going to get this or I'm going to die. And plain and simple. And I kept it in my head that I could always kill myself if this got too hard. And I did the deal, you know? And I'm one of those more slowly, but the program works. You know, and my life has been unbelievable in sobriety. And 2 years ago, I reached a point, something was going on in my life, and I was not going to let go and let God. See, I was going to fix it because I make things happen. I am, you know, I am the great Debbie. And,
You know, I was going to change it. And somewhere along the line, I forgot that, you know, let go. And I got Valium to help me sleep. And they didn't. And looking back on it, that was God. Because I can tell you right now that if the Valium would have worked and it would have helped me sleep, I would be out there right now. I couldn't even see that at the time. You know? And I picked up a white chip. And that was the worst day of my life. And it dawned on me that whatever I'd been doing for the past 11 years, I had gotten complacent. Somewhere along the line, I needed to either change or I was going to go back out or have a stroke, one of the two. And the last 2 years of my sobriety has been unbelievable. And to learn that I'm okay. I spent 11 years being sober, trying to prove what a badass I am. And I no longer have to do that. You know, and that I'm standing up here from where I come from is never did I plan this, ever. When I was out there using, everything was expendable. People, cars, possessions, whatever. There was nothing that was important enough for me to want to keep. You know? And it was a dog-eat-dog world. That was my belief system. AA has taught me that I don't have to wake up every day. I don't have to wake up every day ready to do battle. Because that's how I think. Every day I wake up, and my mind is going on what I have to do battle with today. And we're not meant to live like that. You know, after I took the Valium, I realized I needed to, I spent a lot of time really getting to know a higher power. Because I believed in a higher power, but things were definitely out of my control. You know, and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. I really didn't know anything. And it's been a learning thing, you know, I can't explain the last 2 years. You know, I said that I'm a slow learner, you know, and 7 years sober. You know, I always say that I have faith. You know, I think we're all taught that when we first get sober. Oh, yeah, I have faith. It's all going to work out, you know. And I remember at 7 years sober, I called my sponsor and I said, I trust God, and that's what I call my higher power. And I didn't even know there was a difference between trust and faith. And see, I used to try to bargain with him. You know, I'd say, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you. And then I tried getting mad at him. And then I tried begging. And then I tried making a deal. You know, God just was never giving me what I wanted. Thank God, you know. But, I mean, I was always, you know, I was always questioning, you know, in sobriety. Why? You know, why isn't this working out? I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. Why is this happening? You know, just always. And I remember at 7 years in, it hit me. Oh, my God. I don't see the big picture. All I see is what Debbie needs, Debbie wants right now. And I quit questioning. I don't ask why, you know? I don't try to bargain, and I don't question. And that was awesome when that happened. You know, what scares me is that even though I trust God at 7 years, how do I get to a point at 11 years where I'm not even going to let go? And I don't trust God to handle that. You know? Sometimes I just need to be hit in the head with a 2x4. See, because I thought I could just be the be-all, do-all, you know, Debbie makes shit happen. People that know me laugh at that. And I don't. You know? God, I have so much time to kill. So I can go back and tell you all the rest. Usually I have a few minutes to kind of calm down, and today's just kind of been a hectic day, so I'm just like flying by the seat of my pants, trying not to think about my day. But I never, you know, I knew at such an early age that, or my way of thinking was, if you knew the real me, that there was something wrong with me. You know, since I wasn't supposed to be Jewish, and I remember my mom's brother telling me not to tell anyone I was Jewish because he didn't want any of his friends to know that his sister had married a Jew. And whatever happened at an early age, I just never fit in. I needed to be better. I needed to be better than what I was. And that carried with me even into sobriety. I could do more, be better. I just had to do a little more. And I learned in sobriety that I don't have to. You know, I got sober to be comfortable in my own skin. And it's been a long road. It's been a long road to get there. You know, I rode the bus, you know, when I got sober, like I told you, I was one of those that had everything on the side of the road. And I rode the bus for 2 years. Wasn't planning on that, but I couldn't find anyone in AA to buy me a car. And I really thought they should, because everybody bought me cars when I was out there drinking. I didn't get it that you get sober and nobody buys you a car. You know, and I got a car. And I went in to get a license plate. And I told the lady, I said, I want a personalized plate. And she goes, okay, write it down. So I wrote it down. And she looked at it and she goes, do you have another way of spelling it? Because usually they're taken. So do you have a couple ways of spelling it? And I said, no, let's just do that. And if it's taken, it's taken. So she looks at it and she goes, second chance. She goes, why do you want second chance? And I just looked at her and I thought, you're being really nosy. And, you know, I'm just looking at her, this big black lady cop. And I'm just looking at her. And she goes, is that because you were dying and you were given a second chance at life? And I said, oh, my God, you know, God is a big black lady. And I just started crying, you know, and I looked at her and I go, yeah. I didn't know what else to say. And she looked it up on the computer and she goes, oh, it's not taken. And things like that have happened all through my life. You know, I bought that car. I got that license plate 9 years ago. And now I own a business called that. If I got what I deserve, I'd be dead. And what you see standing before you is not the way I used to run. And I should be dead or be in jail. And this is none of my doing. You know, I remember when I first got sober and they used to read in the book, God is everything or God is nothing. And I go, yeah, whatever. And you know, I believe that. I shouldn't be standing here today. You know? God, you guys, I am so sorry. I'm so trying to stay focused on talking. And I don't know if this has ever happened. Well, at least I'm not going out by ambulance. So, but, you know, I'm very distracted. So, I'm probably not making any sense. Can I be done? No? Did you say no?
You're speaking.
Oh, okay. I am so sorry. And I have to tell you, I've told my story a million times, and the point I want to get across, I have people here that came out here specifically tonight to hear me. And I thank you. I'm dead serious about recovery. And this disease knows no age or gender or black or white. And I hope that I hope everyone takes it serious. And it's by the grace of God, because I can tell you, I did not wake up one day and say, I want to be sober. Because I was not coming back to AA. And I was done. You know? And it was none of my doing that they took me to the hospital. And then I came back and said, I'm going to try this thing one more time. You know, and I'm flabbergasted from where I come from and how I was. I'm not nice. I'm not nice when I'm out there using. Well, I'm nice if you have something I want. but I'm not nice. And this disease robbed me of anything being human. You know, I didn't need human contact. I didn't need a phone. I didn't need anything human. And I had no compassion. I didn't give a damn about anybody. And that's what I gave to the disease. I didn't care. And it's taken years to even start to feel human again. I didn't understand people that actually, you know, felt bad if they hurt somebody's feelings or that had family members that they talked to and loved, because, you know, I disowned my family. I don't need anybody. And qualities of being human has taken time to come back. So I gave pretty much everything to the disease to keep on running, you know? And and now I love my life. And I don't know how I got here. And I apologize, but I'm done.